The 50th ancestor was priest Tian Tong Rujing. Tendo Nyojo Dayosho. Tian Tong was the mountain where he lived, Heaven's Child Mountain, and his name Rujing, or Nyojo, means suchness, purity, which I think is quite interesting. Maybe we'd even say that the purity of Nyojo is purity. Yeah. Seems to be a big issue in his life. From early on, he had this name. Rujing, Nyojo, the purity of suchness. He studied with Shui Do. Shui Do asked him, "Disciple Rujing, how can something that has never been defiled be purified?" Or this translation says, "How can something that's never been soiled be cleaned?" The master Rujing spent more than a year on this question. Suddenly he was awakened and said, "I have hit upon that which is undefiled, not soiled." That's the story of Rujing's awakening. Rujing is most known to us as Dogen's teacher. So he's the source of the Soto school of Japan. Maybe not so well known in China at that time, although Dogen said he was the only true teacher in China. Rujing was a native of Yuezhou. His initiatory name was Rujing. After the age of 17, he abandoned doctrinal studies and practiced Zen. He joined Shui Do's community and spent a year there. He always excelled in Zazen. Once he asked to be the sanitation officer, or we might say the toilet cleaner. But the I guess it's one of the positions in the monastery. And I don't know if this comes from Japan or if it was kind of added in, but at Tassajara, there's a position called Benji that's the like assistant to the Shuso. And their job, actually the Shuso and the Benji together are the toilet cleaners. I don't know how it is in Japan. But the compost turners and the toilet cleaners. And it's kind of a beautiful tradition that's carried on at Tassajara and Green Gulch. The most honorable position, the head seat of the practice period, is has the kind of maybe dirtiest job. It's kind of nice. Yeah. So he asked to be the toilet cleaner, but this, in Japanese, the name of this position is Jocho, the purity head, the head of purity. That's how they, you know, the dignified names of these positions, they can't use a word for toilet, right? The head of purity is the toilet cleaner. So, Nyojo wanted to be the Jocho. So this is the same Jo in his name. The purity of suchness wanted to be the head of purity. He was into this purification issue. He wanted to purify himself by purifying the toilets. And so he asked his teacher, Shui Do, "Can I be the head of purity?" And probably figuring, Well, of course, no one else wants to do this job. He won't mind. He'd be happy if I'm volunteering. And Shweta said, how can something that's never been defiled be purified? Or how can something that's never been soiled be cleaned? If you can answer that, I will appoint you to be the head of purity, the toilet cleaner. Give him a Zen test. If you can, literally says, if you can express something, again, this word dotoku means like, express yourself about this point, then you can have this job. How can something that's never been defiled be purified? The master was at a loss. When they say the master here, it's because they honor the ancestor in this story. So he's the student. But that's the way that the text is set up. The master, Ru Jing, is the student here. But he's at a loss. After several months, he still had no answer. Once Shui Do invited him to his quarters and asked him, do you have an answer for our earlier discussion? But he was still unable to answer. Again, Shui Do asked, how can something that has never been defiled be purified? Again, he did not answer for more than a year. Again, Shui Do asked, can you answer? Ru Jing still could not answer. Shui Do said, if you can climb out of your old rut, you will be free. Or if you can climb out of your old nest, you can be free. Then you'll be able to answer. Like the way that you've been thinking about this for the past year is probably like off track. And you're probably turning it over and over in kind of the maybe some variations on the theme, but the theme is in the rut. Hearing this, Ru Jing investigated with all his strength and determination. One day, he was suddenly awakened. Again, Satori, he understood something. He went to Shui Do's quarters and told him, I can answer. I can make a dotoku. An expression. Shui Do said, this time say it. Ru Jing said, I have hit upon that which is undefiled. Even before he finished speaking, Shui Do hit him. Ru Jing broke out in sweat and bowed in prostration. Then Shui Do gave him his approval. So, what does pure mean? And defiled. Sometimes we talk about the kleshas. Klesha is often translated as defilements or afflictions. And these are like greed, hate, and delusion. Sometimes they're expanded into six. Greed, hate, and illusion. Pride, fixed views, and doubt. And there's various other Abhidharma lists of kleshas. Those are like the major kleshas, and there's like the subsidiary kleshas, and there's a lot of defilements, and this means they're like, they you could say they, this word implies that they kind of muddy or obscure that old fellow, the brightness of our true nature. So, of course, this brightness of our true nature is originally undefiled, can never be impure. In other words, it can't be caught up in the suffering of these kleshas that are based on the fixed view of the independent self and the solidity of the world, me and mine. But this is his way of talking in the Indian tradition. I think the Indian culture is really into this idea of purity and impurity, in a kind of, when talking about the mind. So the originally perfect brightness of this boundless clarity, the awareness that doesn't come and go, that's part of its definition, is that there's nothing defiled there. It can't actually be defiled, and the defilements of greed, hate, and delusion actually can't really touch that awareness, right? And yet they appear to obscure it. So often it's spoken of in the Mahayana, there's two obscurations. Obscurations to this pure Buddha nature. Obscuration is avarana. Avarana is like a kind of like a curtain or block or hindrance or obscuration, I think is the best translation. So there's the klesha avarana, the obscurations of the defilements, which emotional, afflictive emotions. That's another translation of klesha. So the afflictive emotions block or obscure the Buddha nature. And then in the Mahayana, they say there's also the nyeya avarana, the obscuration of subtle duality, dualistic thought. You could say maybe the klesha of delusion is more kind of a gross delusion, and that this is on the later stages of the bodhisattva path is the obscuration due to actually just cognition has to drop away. That somewhat blocks this true nature. And it's usually said, first we work on the klesha avarana, the obscurations of these defilements. And they're, I think, the most, tangible, obvious suffering comes from these kleshas, actually. Maybe very, very subtle discontent comes from these cognitive obscurations. So how can something that's never been defiled be purified? So we could say one way of looking at this issue is that is the Buddha nature actually defiled when we're angry or greedy? And so we can say, no, actually, it never is. It's the greed and anger are kind of are all around it like a veil that obscure it. And then we could say, well, what are these greed, hate, and delusion? What are they made of? Where do they come from? And we could say, well, they must come from this Buddha nature itself. Everything is a manifestation of Buddha nature. Greed, hate, and delusion. In other words, there's nothing outside of Buddha nature, actually. Because if there was, we'd have this issue, we have this problem. Well, where would it come from? Is it just like, and maybe this is the issue in other religions too, like, is there a devil outside of God? Or is devil kind of like a, somehow working with God or some aspect of, because if you say God includes everything, then what about the devil? So I think, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, we'd say everything is a kind of like manifestation, an emanation, an expression of this true nature. It's that the true nature manifests the obscurations that then block the true nature. That's the strange thing. That's one way of looking at it. I think kind of a helpful way to look at it, because then we can start to see that these obscurations actually are also pure, really, in their nature, because they're manifestations of Buddha nature. It's just that they appear to be like these major problems and blockage to the true nature. They appear to be defiled, but actually the kleshas themselves are originally undefiled, you could say, at least in the Mahayana. And the dharmic traditions that tend towards non-duality. Like Nagarjuna famously expressed, samsara itself, which is the cycle of suffering based on kleshas, samsara itself is nirvana, which is the perfect, pure freedom. And then, you know, he goes on to expound how this is so. Yeah, this is kind of the flavor of the great vehicle. So, when we're practicing with these kleshas of greed, hate, and delusion, we'd like to remove them. They're obscuring our Buddha nature. We'd like to do something about them so we can actually rest in our pure, free, true nature. But if the nature of the kleshas is already pure, how can they be purified? That's one way to hear this question, right? Disciple Ru Jing, how can something that's never been defiled, it's never really been defiled, how can it be purified? In other words, this really points to approaches to practice. I have to remove these kleshas of greed, hate, and delusion by training the mind over and over, by shifting my habits over and over through great effort. We have images of polishing the mirror. The mirror of true nature, this dust of defilement keeps landing on the mirror. We have to keep polishing it and wiping it clean so that the mirror is pure. We don't want a dusty mirror. And then the sixth ancestor of Zen says, actually, there's no place for this dust to land. And what is the dust anyway? Could it be that the dust is actually just reflections on the surface of the mirror? It's not actually some sticky, gooey gunk that needs lots of Windex. Windex does not remove reflections. Well, see, I wish I could get that face off the mirror there. Doesn't seem to work. And maybe the spirit of cleaning the toilets is almost like a metaphor, right? Of like, if I can just keep polishing these dirty old toilets, this is kind of like polishing my mind. But his teacher's pointing to something deeper. How can that which has never been defiled be purified? And he worked on this for a long time and came to some understanding. And his answer is just that I have hit upon that which is undefiled. Or that's what I've been investigating and discovered, hit upon. I've struck gold, that which is undefiled. Can't get a hold of that. Can't do anything about it, as we heard in the last chapter. Even the Buddhas and ancestors can't do anything about it. And it's not something that comes and goes. But it's always right here. The undefiled brightness. So then what's practice about, right? This was Dogen's great question, right? As you may have heard. The teachings in his, popular teachings in his day, before Zen even came to Japan, the teachings of the Chiantai school were that the teachings of original enlightenment, that enlightenment is not something that you gradually attained. It's originally always here, perfectly pure from the start. And everybody is endowed with this from the beginning. There's nothing to purify. So this was Dogen's question. I keep hearing this teaching. We're already completely, perfectly enlightened. So why did all these ancestors make this great effort and struggle to realize this enlightenment? It's already right here. This was his big koan, right, that drove him to practice. And you could say his whole life's work after resolving this, after hitting upon the great matter, is an expression of his understanding of the unity of practice and realization. Expressed, for example, at the end of the Genjo Koan, Zen Master Baoche was fanning himself, and the monk approached and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent, undefiled, pure from the start. There's no place it doesn't reach. It's everywhere. Why are you practicing? Wind is like pervading you. Why are you making this effort to move this wind like this with your fan? It's already here." Playing with this image to bring up this question. The nature of wind is permanent, all-pervading. There's no place it doesn't reach. Why do you fan yourself? And Baoche said, "Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, you don't understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." We might even add in purity. You understand its purity, but you don't understand how this purity reaches everywhere. "What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the monk. The master just kept fanning himself. how do we manifest the wind of the Buddha's house, this great pure brightness. How do we manifest that everywhere? How do we practice when everything's perfect from the start? So maybe almost everything Dogen says is kind of like dancing around and celebrating this issue. But particularly when we're talking about purity here, this came to mind from the Shobo Genzo, this chapter called Purifying or Cleansing in this translation. Cleaning up. Senjo. In Shobo Genzo, Senjo. This is the same jo as Nyojo. The purity of suchness. So this is like, sen also means like purifying. Sen and jo are both like purity or purifying. Purifying and purifying. Purifying purity. You could translate it as all in these kinds of ways. Kaz Tanahashi calls it cleansing. So, purity and defilement is approached in this essay. Dogen says, the practice realization that Buddhas and ancestors have guarded and maintained is called non-defilement. Nanyue was once asked by Huineng, the sixth ancestor, do you depend on practice and realization? Nanyue said, it's not that there's no practice and realization, it's just that it should not be defiled. Or you could translate it as, it's just that it cannot be defiled. Practice-realization. We could translate it as, is there no practice and realization? And then you always say, it's not that there's no practice realization, it's just that it can't be defiled. One to say it can't be defiled is that is saying, it's describing its nature, how it is, it can't be defiled. And to translate it as it should not be defiled is kind of talking about more like the practice around it. We might even say, because it can't be defiled, don't defile it. What is defiling practice? -realization. It could be to say that practice and realization are two things as it appears to an ordinary person, where each could be recognized separately. Therefore, practice would be something that eventually would lead to realization of purity, rather than practice itself is pure from the beginning, and therefore the realization of purity is right there, one with the practice from the beginning. And then Huineng said, this non-defilement is what all Buddhas have mindfully guarded. You are like this, I am like this, all ancestors in India were like this. So, in this chapter on purification, he brings up the story about non-defilement. Maybe Dogen's favorite story about non-defilement. Then Dogen says, the Sutra of the 3,000 Guidelines for Pure Conduct says, to purify your body means to wash away excrement and urine and to cut your 10 fingernails. So it's like, now we're getting practical. This is what actually purifying the body is. Then Dogen says, thus even if the body and mind are undefiled, there are methods of cleansing or purifying the body and purifying the mind. Even if, or even though, body and mind are undefiled, there are methods for purifying the body and mind. It's not only purifying the body and mind, but also purifying the entire land, purifying the places for sitting under trees. Even if the land is not polluted, purifying it is the intention of all Buddhas. They do not turn their backs on it or give it up, even after they reach the fruit of Buddhahood. The essential meaning of purification is difficult to fathom. The method of purification is itself the essential meaning. Attaining the way is the method of purification. And then there's a whole essay about these practical things, practical points of purification, where actually Dogen quotes Ru Jing quite a bit and says, that gets into some rants about like priests not shaving their heads and stuff like this. And he brings up some verses from the Avatamsaka Sutra, the pure conduct chapter. And there's a verse that I like to recite this verse when I remember a verse for sitting on the toilet. In the great Avatamsaka Sutra, there's a verse for everything. The verse goes, using the toilet, may all beings be free, using the toilet, may all beings eliminate defilement, free from greed, hate, and illusion. Yes.
You die when you cease having the ability to do that.
Yep, it's true. And there's nothing, there's nothing impure about piles of poop. Some of the ancestors even realized awakening upon like realizing the purity of pee and poop and vomit and these kinds of things. Right? It's just our human customs and standards that call these things impure. So it's interesting that I think this chapter in particular, Dogen's saying everything's pure from the start, and then he gets into all these like practices of purification. And I like the part that he just mentioned of even if the land is not polluted, purifying it is the intention of all Buddhas. It's kind of an environmental statement. I think we could hear it. The environment is inherently and originally unpolluted. There's never been any pollution anywhere, right? And the Buddhas and ancestors sometimes go out and clean up the garbage on the beach or whatever. Not to like purify the defiled beach, but how can we say it? Like, to be in accord with the original purity. You could say cleaning up the garbage is like making our like manifest life more in accord with the original purity of the beach. if it's a fanning like this, there's no real reason because the wind's already here. But the fanning is like more in accord with the wind that's circulating everywhere. One could argue this kind of thing, I think, and say, but isn't everything equally in accord? Isn't throwing garbage on the beach also in accord? And maybe from some, you know, very ultimate or even nihilistic perspective, we could say, yeah, this is where everything's the same, so it doesn't matter. Rujing's going to get into this point. But practically speaking, I think this is the interesting part about this purity issue and practice in general, especially from a non-dual practice perspective. And I think this is quite a big issue in this world, because especially in modern America, many spiritual practitioners are drawn to the non-dual traditions. And they are, like, in the highest spiritual teachings on the planet. And I think every like world religion has them as their maybe secret or hidden heart of teachings. And I think, you know, Zen and Dzogchen and Advaita Vedanta are maybe most known for being a kind of their exoteric teachings are like these radical non-dual teachings. And I think the reason we're drawn to them is because because when we really open deeply to them, it's like it's this great new, everything is perfect, right, from the start. It's not like we're a big mess that we have to like work on forever. And yet, the more non-dual, maybe you can't really say more non-dual, right? There's more and less are not relevant in non-duality. But the completely non-dual expressions have this danger in that if everything's completely pure from the start, then we can fall into this kind of complacent, do-nothing kind of practice. And then there's no reason to pick up the garbage on the beach. Yes?
That's why we have emptiness as form.
Yeah, emptiness itself is form.
Teaching, we are reminded that emptiness is form.
But we still might say emptiness is form, so emptiness is the form of the garbage on the beach. There it is, empty garbage manifesting on the beach. Fine.
Ignore cause and effect.
Yeah, and we might say the bodhisattva vow to benefit others. We could say suffering itself is empty. The Heart Sutra does say that, right? No suffering. No cause of suffering. No cessation of suffering and no path leading to the cessation of suffering. And yet, that's the beauty and wonder of this bodhisattva vow is that even though there aren't any beings and there isn't any suffering, and you could say, there's suffering manifests and beings manifest, but it's just empty manifestations. Still, this particular vow is like, let's do this particular thing about these suffering beings. Like, give our lives to try to relieve it. And some, like Advaita Vedanta, I don't think really has this vow, my understanding. It might naturally manifest in the realization of non-separation between me and you, certainly won't harm you, and maybe there's a natural response, compassionate response. And so now, yes?
I just want to make sure I'm sort of tracking on this.
Mm-hmm.
I may not be. So, the body is undefiled naturally, is in accord with everything.
The body, yeah. Because?
Because it's connected to everything. I mean, it's just part of Buddha nature.
Yeah.
Sure, it's undefiled.
Yeah, or we might say it's a manifestation of Buddha nature, like everything else, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. However, the body does get dirty.
Yeah.
But that, and so when we take a bath, that is in accord with, just bringing it back in accord with, I don't know, is bringing back a good word? Is it bringing back or just practicing in accord with its connectedness to the rest of Buddha nature? Or is it, how do you say that? Everything is perfect, the body is undefiled, the body gets dirty, they sound like they are different, but they're not. I know they're not different. It's something here in the words. So, I'm
going
to fix my words.
I think mainly when I think of accord, when I think of having the conventional world and our behavior and activities be in accord with Buddha nature, the way I think of that at this time is like the harmony. It's in accord with like the selfless the selfless reality where there's no antagonism or mindless self-centeredness, right? So I think so. The example of the trash on the beach is kind of like, I guess I think of like people who just like drop trash on the beach is kind of like a mindless self-centeredness. So it's like that activity, like I think if you're really in accord with the pure suchness when you're walking on the beach, at least my projection is you wouldn't just like throw your can down there. It's like, I mean, somebody might, right? But I think in general we wouldn't, because it's like, why would we? Unless there's some beneficial reason. Maybe that's another way. To be in accord with the pure true nature is like everything in that this awareness, this undefiled awareness, is naturally connected and beneficent. So bathing the body is maybe a trickier. We could say maybe then we're just according with the customs of society where people aren't so into body odors. But in some cultures they are, or they don't mind it so much, right? But you could say it's not really harming others exactly to not bathe, but I think you could say it's according with the customs of the time, just like cutting fingernails in this chapter. There's nothing really harmful about growing your fingernails long, but it's kind of like the Zen style. In the priest meeting the other day, we read Dogen's, we were discussing how Dogen talking about the Bodhisattva precepts as, one of his students was really into the Bodhisattva precepts and was constantly reciting them and trying to always get it just right. And Dogen's like, I think this is a little too much. It's like we practice these precepts just because they're the lifestyle in a Zen monastery. Maybe he was also talking about monastic precepts like cutting fingernails and stuff. It's not that there's like that we have to do this just right. It's like, let's not get too obsessed about it. We just do it because in this context, in this social setting, this is how we practice. And It was quite interesting and unusual, I think, or surprising for me when I first read that, because almost like it's not a big deal, but it is important to like kind of accord with the situation, and the situation is going to be different in different settings. So like in sesshin, we slow down and we're very careful and to be very quiet and like, well, that's appropriate to accord with the setup of sesshin. But then after sesshin, if we go dancing or something, then there's some other way to accord with the situation. Yeah? Accord is kind of a tricky thing. According with the reality of non-separation, where everything is in harmony, and in this situation, the harmony of a dance party requires a certain kind of accord. To actually keep the harmony, if somebody like just sits down in zazen in the middle of the dance floor or something, and like, this is the harmony, people are like, this is actually annoying, we're going to step on you, get out of the way.
I'm going to say something up because it looks like you're kind of looking at social norms in this context. But with the bathing, I just kept thinking, creatures keep themselves clean. That's what they do. And if you find a wild creature that is not clean, it's usually because it's sick. So it's like Wu Wei. It is the nature of creatures to clean themselves.
And then there's, within that, though that is true, within that then there's all different gradations, right? Like in our culture, maybe majority of people take a shower like every day, but in other cultures that would be like unheard of. So I think it's a social thing to a point, and then it becomes like the Wu Wei of all humans at some point. And it's interesting, like the Zen in Japan, in the Zen monastery, we could only take a bath every 5 days. And so people did smell. And I think it was a bit more, even though this was Dogen's school about purity, I think it was also about frugality in that case, because it was a wood-fired bath and you had to like gather these branches from around the temple and there are only so many. What's the appropriate response in each situation is hard to say. It's changing constantly. So here's some of how after Lu Jing hit on that which is undefiled, how he lived. So kind of like about his practical life now, which is Lu Jing is Dogen praises him a lot, and Keizan here praises him as like one of the particularly pure ancestors in the sense of his very simple life. And I'll read a little bit, and then I have questions about this, even maybe like lifetime koan, actually, personally. About this, so if I forget my lifetime koan, remind me to bring it up. Later at Qingzu Monastery, which interestingly is called Pure Compassion Monastery, it's that same character again, Lu Jing became the toilet cleaner in order to So this is actually, I think, a different temple now. He became the toilet cleaner at this different place in order to requite the occasion of his awakening. Because you could say his whole, this kind of contemplation he was doing that led to his awakening was all about like wanting to be the toilet cleaner and looking for that which is undefiled. So he's like, this fact of my great awakening kind of like was connected with this issue of being the toilet cleaner. So now to repay this wonderful gift of my awakening, I want to be a toilet cleaner everywhere. That's how I understand it. Once when he was passing the hall of the Arhats, where all the 16 great Arhats are like these statues enshrined, a strange monk said to him, "Cleaner of toilets at Qingzi, Rujing, you repay the way, or you requite the way, requite your teacher and requite all people." So saying, he disappeared. The prime minister of the country heard about this and interpreted it to be an omen that the sages approved of the master becoming the abbot of Qingzi Monastery. These kind of stories happened in the old days. He was walking by the Arhat's hall and like some strange unknown monk came by like one of the Arhats, right? Said, you're requiting your blessings is very good. So consequently, he did become the abbot of Qingzi. People everywhere said that his merits of repaying his debt were really supreme. Since arousing the determination for awakening, or arousing bodhicitta at the age of 18, he stayed in the monastery and never returned to his native home. Not only that, but he never associated with his countrymen or went to the rooms of others in the monastery. He did not speak with those who sat near him in the meditation hall. All he ever did was single-minded zazen, shikan taza. I think it's visiting others' rooms, like kind of hanging out and chatting with others. He just sat. He vowed, "I will sit so long that I will crush a diamond seat." As a result of doing zazen like this, sometimes the flesh on his buttocks split open, got these calluses and sores, but he would not stop sitting. From the time he first aroused bodhicitta up to the age of 64 when he died, while he was at Mount Tiantong, there was not a single day or night when he did not do zazen. So this Dogen maybe became a zazen freak, inspired by Rujing. What's that?
I said Dogen ate that up.
Dogen ate that up, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or maybe that's why he stayed. What he says later, like, these other abbots never really practice zazen. They just, like, have tea with the guests. For Rujing, he just would sit. From the time he first became abbot of Qingzi and during the time he was at Mount Shui Yan and Mount Tiantong, his conduct was outstanding. He vowed to be the same as the monks in the monks' hall. Therefore, even though he had the patch robe transmitted by Furong Daokai, which is interesting, I think, historically, that this is like five or six generations earlier. Furong Daokai was one of the great revivers of the Shaodong tradition in China, and it seems like at points in time they would pass along the robe of that teacher. So since this is maybe hundreds of years later, or a hundred or so, it was probably like a great treasure. Maybe he didn't wear it because it's so old and he wants to like not to ruin it, right? But he had this Furong's patched robe, but he didn't wear it. Whether giving formal talks or in his own Dokusan room, he wore only black okesa and robe. So this is like, I think, a kind of a humble attitude, I think, in China at that time, and still in modern, like modern Japan, the abbots often have like brocade okesas, which is kind of funny because it's the patch robe, right? It's like made of these patches from the Buddha's time. You should gather scraps together and sew them together and make a patch robe, meaning like total frugality, like don't even use a whole piece of cloth. Of course, nowadays we symbolically do this, but we take a big piece of cloth and we cut it into scraps and sew them together. And I think that's been going on for a long time too. But it represents that. I think we could say that the robe represents simplicity and frugality. Yeah, I wonder. I mean, maybe or maybe not, right? Maybe it was that was Edjo's like formal announcement, right? So he's so Japanese that maybe he's saying, just in case. But I actually do have the sense. I think it's pretty rare at this conference we were at. They for the most exalted Dharma heritage ceremony, they have a rotating doshi each year. I think they're kind of going through seniority of the people who were, you know, ordained in the early 70s. We're still on there. And they have this brocade robe, but I was asking, what? So what's that? Is that, I wondered, is that yours, Edjo? And he's like, no, actually the SCBA owns this robe. The association bought it. So nobody owns it, and it's just worn for the ceremony once a year. And a giant, like, nyo-y stick. And so I think this is part of the flavor of American Zen, actually, is that I don't think I've ever seen anyone wear a brocade. Brocade usually means, like, it's all decorated with all kinds of, like, you know, phoenixes and dragons and, you know, pictures woven in, and maybe Baker Roshi had some for special events. And what I've heard too is that in modern Japan, it's because it's the custom, like the abbot where at the place I practiced was really, I feel like, was trying to live the life of Dogen, you know, really simple. And yet for like funerals or annual ceremonies, of course he had these brocade robes. And I heard, I don't know, from him or from somebody who's like, somebody who was kind of regretting, I feel kind of funny wearing this robe, but like the people who come to the funerals expect it. And it's kind of like honoring the deceased. So if the abbot wears like a simple robe for the funeral, the family feels insulted. I think in our culture we don't have that, I don't think. Maybe we'd have it in a fancy Catholic ceremony or something if somebody doesn't get all dressed up. What's that about? Yes. I think Suzuki Roshi did, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think probably most of the priests that came from Japan probably had those, but it maybe didn't catch on in America. Or like, also, you know, you buy these, and they're like, I mean, these catalogs, they're like thousands and thousands of dollars, right? For the patched rags.
If you think about
Well, maybe it was a special event. So. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Anyway, it sounds like that was a custom at this time in China that the abbots did wear these brocade robes, but Ru Jing never did. Even though he was offered a purple robe and master's title by the emperor of the Jia Ting era, he declined them. This is also a custom, I think, that also carried on in Japan, the purple okesa. You know, this Buddhism is like this national religion, so to be like kind of like honored as a national teacher by the emperor, you know, what do they give these monks? All they have is robes. So they give them an okesa, but like a purple one symbolizes like the imperial approval. And it's this kind of like this status thing connected with these worldly values, because I think the emperors often weren't practitioners, and it was a political thing, right? If you receive the emperor's robe, then you're kind of like, you have to kind of maybe do some stuff that the emperor wants you to do. And so Ru Jing didn't want these ties, so he refused this great honor from the emperor. Furthermore, he kept secret the matter of who made him a successor, only revealing it at the end when he was about to die by offering incense in recognition. Maybe his teacher was famous. It's not so clear why that would be like a kind of like, maybe like it's like a name dropping thing, right? I know there's one teacher in America, Sherry Huber, is a Zen teacher, who refuses to say who her teacher is. And she practiced with a Japanese Zen teacher in a kind of intensive monastic setting somewhere in California decades ago. Someone who's long gone, not at any of the major Zen centers. And so of course people are curious about this. And she's like, I actually met her once at Tassajara, and like I was driving her out or something. So I noticed that, like, I'm interested in like people's background, actually. I like to know. I like her books, actually. And I'm like, well, who is this person? And she doesn't say anything about herself. So I was like, who are you? who did you practice with? And she's like, I don't like to say, because once you say, you know, who your teacher is, and people say, oh, then I know they're part of that lineage, and they're like that, and they just like check it off, and like they kind of size you up and put you in a box. And she's like, it doesn't matter. And I thought, wow, that's gutsy and unusual to really not say. And I think somewhat of an issue in modern, in the SCBA, it's an issue. So like in the email conversations, Zen teachers, you know, pop up around the country regularly, mysteriously sprout. and they're in the news or whatever. Somebody finds some Zen center online. Who is that person? And they put it out. Has anyone heard of this person? And if, you know, if they're on their website, they don't say who their teacher or their lineage is. The SCBA gets kind of like riled up. Some people in the SCBA get kind of worked up about it. Well, then we got to stop this. Or we don't like people who don't say. Actually, and I think it's because it's sort of like this self, that's a beauty, I think. I think this is the beauty of the Zen tradition from ancient times that is now carrying on in this country, that it's, nobody makes it up on their own. You know, it's, if you're authorized to teach by your teacher, by another person. You know, people could authorize too easily or too strictly or whatever, but at least there's some relationship. You could say that's the bottom line. This is about relationship. But anyway, Ru Jing is kind of like Sherry Huber. He didn't want to say till he he was about to die, who his teacher was. He not only kept far away from mundane desires and fame, but was also concerned for the good reputation of the Zen school. Truly, no one at the time equaled his virtue. His conduct was exemplary, then and now. He always said to himself, in the last century or two, the way of the ancestors has declined. Therefore, no spiritual teacher like me has appeared. Might say, well, he's trying to be very humble, but... But, yeah, he wondered about this kind of thing. He said it to himself. I don't know how Kazan knew that. All other teachers were in awe of him. The master never praised them. He would say, since the age of 19, when I made this strong resolve and went on pilgrimage to visit teachers, I've not met anyone who's enlightened or who has the way. Many teachers just greet visiting officials and never concern themselves with sitting in the monk's hall. They always say, each person must understand the Buddha Dharma himself. So saying, they don't guide the other monks. In other words, like, you all just go sit. I can't help you, really. Everyone's got to work it out on their own. And then they go have tea with the guests. What's more, the present abbots of the great monasteries do the same. They think that not caring about anything is the way, and they never emphasize Zen practice. So this not caring about anything is this term, buji. You heard of buji Zen? Which means like no matter. You could translate it, no matter, no business, not kind of like not doing anything, and is a kind of like nihilistic, not caring attitude based on the fact that everything's empty. So it doesn't matter. It's kind of like the trash on the beach is empty, so it's just pure Dharmakaya, so just whatever. Let's add some to it. Whatever. It's buji Zen, and so that's what Tendo Nyodo is critiquing. So, it's an interesting issue of everything. How can that which has never been defiled be purified? And yet, we have to really practice diligently and help each other and that whole side.
So, are you going to tell us your life koan now?
Oh. Shall I?
You said to remind me.
Yeah. It has to do with this kind of like according thing. If one truly and completely realizes the way, then does one's life necessarily look some particular way after that? I guess that's kind of like the gist of my koan. And I think I've heard great teachers come down on very different sides of this question. One of my teachers, Ajahn Amaro, right, who's one of the Thai forest tradition of Theravada Buddhism, are like, they try to, you know, follow the Buddha's way exactly as in the 2500-year-old sutras and Vinaya precepts for how they lived in India at that time. And, you know, of course, there's some modernizations, but they're pretty close. I mean, it's kind of radical. Like, this is really looks like right out of the text. They have the robe and the bowl, and the people come and offer food, and there's all these things. They can't keep anything overnight. And he, you know, I was very attracted to that way, especially as a young man, and talked with him a lot about these things. And his take was kind of like something like, Well, if you really realize no self, and that and the freedom, and the, this inner freedom, then not only is it like, it's not just that it's like neutral, that everything is neutral. It's like, I think his thing is like, well, if this was so for the Buddha, then why didn't he, you know, he was this prince who left the palace. Why didn't he go back to the palace? Because if it was all the same, wouldn't that be nicer? He could have. He was welcome back there, right? And live a very comfortable life with his wife and child. And I think Ajahn Amaro's take was like, actually, with his understanding of the Buddha's realization, it's like, that's impossible. You can't live that way if you realize this. And then maybe from the more non-dual traditions, it's like, well, anything, everything is manifesting Buddha nature. Anything can be it. You know, maybe really, you know, blatantly harming others, of course, is not in accord. But there's a lot of leeway. What is it? Is it harming others to own anything? Some people might get really strict and say, actually, yeah, because other people can use that. And some might say, no, that's going too far. So this is my lifetime koan is as I've tried going back and forth myself between these poles is. You know, is there a way that the way looks? And I think a lot of these stories of the ancestors imply. I mean, this is Kazan talking to the monks in his monastery, so he's bringing up these are the heroes. If you're living in a monastery, these were my heroes. Still are my heroes for in this lifetime, right? Wow, this is how their example of living this way. And then I wonder, in modern times, and especially for me now, it's my koan is amplified moving to Santa Cruz Zen Center after many years in the monastery. And Richard asked the other night, I think some of you are here, we were talking about commitments to the practice period, so on, and it stuck with me. And Richard said, well, here we are here, and it's like, he can do a lot of these things, and he's like, apart from retired people and self-employed people and, you know, people who can, like, here we are in the room, right, it's like people who can swing this a little bit to do this, it's not that many people. How can we do practice period? How can we offer this? And what do you think? Yes.
Well, I'd say maybe I have a couple of life koans, but certainly one of them is really, I always work through that Seijo and her soul are separated.
Mm.
And Catherine was always very helpful for me with that, because I always feel split. You know, and for a long time it was profession and Zen, and, you know, or whatever. You know, I don't have to get into the story of it. But one of the things I remember when she was expounding about that koan was she said, well, you don't discover by trying to figure it out in your mind. You discover by living it. You know, and so in a way, to me, that kind of goes towards the thing you said the other night when Richard asked this question, was the experimenting. And today, how you said you've tried this and you've tried that. My understanding of what Catherine is saying is, well, if there's going to be some insight, like Ru Jing finally going, oh, guess what? I know that place now that's undefiled. Mm. The only way you're going to know it or I'm going to know it is by walking the path. And I think for some of us, we have to keep trying. Both sides. We do keep veering because somehow that's how it gets worked out. It's not like a logic puzzle.
I think that's true.
It's a life experience, realization.
Yeah. And different for everyone.
Pardon?
Different for everyone according to their own karmic situation.
Exactly. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so even in the story, you know, I mean, the koan is which is the real Seijo.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you can't say.
And yet, there is, you know, some integration. At the end, but without any logic of how that integration happened, because it's kind of
I mean what works for us, which is maybe what it all comes down to in the end, what actually works for us, and then maybe another way to ask this for me would be like, well, when bodhicitta is really strong, like, this is the most important thing, then I can question, well, this works for me, but like, it may be actually off track, it may be out of accord, even though it works for me. And that's when the koan gets more amplified. It's like, of course, we're always, maybe another way to say it too, is we're always doing what we want. We never can escape this, where everything we're doing is we're choosing to do that at any moment. So you could say, but then when I notice, I get more in touch with the undefiled, and I say, oh, but actually it's this karma. I'm doing what I want, but driven by deluded patterns, actually.
Yeah, I mean, in the story, you know, she's off living the life she wants to live. She's with the love of her life, they're having children, she's out in the world, but she gets called back to the village. Something, you know, that's not in her...
Yeah.
Construct of how she thinks she's supposed to live her life.
Uh-huh.
And she doesn't abandon her partner and her child, but she gets called, oh, I need to go back to the village. You know, so I think that maybe that is helpful sometimes, is that that being called.
Yes, that's nice.
The realm of what you think.
Yep.
You know.
Being called is no longer like, I'm designing my life. And so how open are we to the calling? Right. That's scary.
And being disturbed can be a call. Like, you know, your example that you gave just now, you're going along and you're going, oh yeah, this is it. And all of a sudden you go, wait, what if it's not?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like
a call.
Whoa, what if I'm wrong?
And what as the and is the calling true? Those voices we hear? Yes.
So you may be familiar with this wonderful classic story of the Mary and Martha, where Jesus liked to hang out and talk to people, and these are sisters, and Martha's in the kitchen working, and Mary's at the feet of the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And Martha's in the kitchen saying, why don't you tell her? Doesn't she realize that we have all these people to feed? She needs to be in here. And it's been a complicated koan, because Jesus says, Martha, Martha, you're worried about many things. Mary has chosen the better path. And some people have construed that to think that it's this contemplative sitting at the feet of the teacher as a better path. But in other breaking open of that koan, it's more that Martha was just conflicted about where she was. That she thought she wanted to be somewhere else, and really she had to be in the kitchen, and why isn't somebody in the kitchen? The conflict not
worrying about it.
It's like if you just were fine making the soup, that would have been the perfect place.
Interesting. Is that how it's unpacked?
So it's kind of interpreted as, well, the beautiful thing about any of these things is that it's a very personal response, but that's how I have come to understand that there isn't a better place. It's how do we arrive at the place we are fully. And Mary was there fully, knew where she needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Martha was not fully there. She was like, I want to be over there.
Yeah.
She should be here.
So that's another way to, that's a beautiful story. Thank you for that. Yeah. I think definitely the same, along the same lines. It's another way we sometimes say it is, it doesn't matter so much what you're doing, but how you're doing it. So, just being completely present and undivided, then the way is manifested. That's kind of the non-dual side of things, right? And so then the question is, I don't know. This is interesting because it's just a, it's a kind of like narrow storyline, right? It's a particular culture and a particular tradition. So, and it's people talking to people in monasteries that have talked, and generations of people talking to people in monasteries. So here we have this particular version. But these 52 stories, they're all like living this same kind of life, right? There's like, couldn't they have thrown in one that's like doing the dishes? And you know, we have like layman Pong and people like this, right? But they're very rare. And so here we are in the middle of this Zen tradition that like it keeps looking like this. this is another part of the challenge, right? Yes. Yeah.
The totality of experience. And so there's probably, just because, you know, we're dependent on translation, there's probably a lot of monastic experience that we don't know about because it's not in the work.
And non-monastic experience, right? Yeah. That's what I mean by like, this is this kind of like narrow stream that's create, and the introduction talks about this is like this genealogy, and it's creating the strength of a particular lineage that's going in a particular direction. So it's part of this social function creates,
To not adhere to that storyline would be seen probably as kind of undermining or unraveling.
Yeah.
The wholeness of
the story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, yeah, it's this particular context and all, and yet part of the problem here is like, this is what we inherited. And this is our tradition, right? new records will continue to be written.
For example.
Yeah. What about women teachers? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's the women teachers, and maybe in the hidden lamp there's some teachers living outside of that kind of context. And then does it change? Then is it the same, you know, is it the same? This is like American Zen, right? This is like this new thing that this is the very beginning. We just get this. They just give us this. And now they have the hidden lamp. So, but now what? Is the next 1,000 years going to unfold? And is it going to be this, or is it going to be something else? And they'll look, wow, look at how that came like all the way from Japan to America, and then it's completely shifted into something. And then is it Soto Zen, right? Is it Dogen Zen? I think these are the things. And does it need to be? Does it need to be, right? Or can we extract pieces of Dogen in this like very narrow sort of context? This is what I think we're already doing. We are extracting this and saying, but this applies to my life right here, in the dish room. And is that valid? And these are our unfolding questions.
I think that was Colvin's whole intention after he went to Sahar, that you know he didn't want to have that tradition. I was talking to a friend who
he did,
sat,
did
he didn't want to didn't have want. That tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a friend who sat with him. This it was his first session. They had started a Zen center in Oregon. And Colvin was the first person who came up there to teach them. Someone had gone consulted with someone at Tassajara. And Colvin actually said that he didn't like Tassajara very much.
Too much like AAG.
I guess so, yeah. And that it was, and in reading and listening to him over the years, it was always his intention to find, to follow his students, so that he could discover from his students what
they needed,
what their intention was, what practice was for them.
Mm-hmm.
He never felt like he was leading anyone. He felt like he was following people, and to give people a space, a lot of space, in which to practice.
Yeah, and then we could question, but it seemed like Kobin did keep some traditions and stuff though too, right? Like he could have done away with like the robes and the sashins and the chanting and things like this, right?
Yeah, although there wasn't a whole lot of the
less so than Tathagata, right? But still could have done, like some people have. People like Adyashanti, right, who's like, it doesn't look like Zen. He doesn't call it Zen anymore, but it's very influenced by, and it doesn't have any kind of container like that. So I get, that's part of our experiment too, is like, this kind of thing, this looks pretty much like a Heiji this week in here, right? And, is this, are we fooling ourselves? Are we playing around? Or is there something really like vital in this kind of setup? These are, yes?
Well, certainly the Catholic Church has about 2,000 years on this idea of sort of trying to internationalize a teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And what it looks like all over the world is very different. Mm-hmm. Then comes this thing called orthodoxy, which shows up in things like ritual, but then there's the praxis, which is what shows up in the practice. I think that's what's sort of interesting and at play, where we can get, we have to have some of that orthodoxy. It's the form and the structure, but it's also the thing that can kill the making it be what the people of the time need, what the culture needs, is to come back to the kind of root, the root of the practice.
Yeah.
What Zen is, or
Yeah, I think another issue in this mix too is about like degrees, or like how far we want to go with things. This is another thing, because I think no one would deny that like the way that Zen practice is coming to America through and filtered into mindfulness and Bodhisattva precepts and all these different aspects that really are helping people. I mean, it wouldn't have gone on this long, right?
iPhones? Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah. It came from Zen, that's right. Yeah. Apple computers are definitely an offshoot of Zen. So I think that's clear. And then we could add in maybe like this tricky area of like the Kazons maybe kind of emphasizing of this like complete like penetrating the source and breaking through to perfect awakening, right? And you could say that maybe isn't as emphasized in American Zen. So you could say he's kind of like emphasizing that little like kind of a narrow piece, and that where often people are looking, if people have that intention, then their lives start looking like this, particular setup. And I think it's interesting about Kobin wanting to see what the people wanted and how they would go. And maybe Kazan might say something, or, in his fiercer moments might say, but the people are totally deluded. How do they know? We're being guided by a bunch of, like, karmic patterns and stuff. And So in a way, it's like it's a beautiful vision because it's like just responding, and yet that's the flip side that one could bring up too, right?
Well, I think that that Koban was feeling like Zazen itself. Definitely, that's what he was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, would be the teacher, and that the rituals and whatever manifested around the practice of Zazen would come from the from this practice of Zazen, and then.
So that's a little bit different twist, yeah.
Yeah.
To say,
say that, you know, well, someone would ask him about how to do a certain thing, and he says, well, just make it up. And at some point, somebody made it up. So that, I think he was talking about that. He wasn't talking about doing away with Zazen.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, or yeah. I was kind of picturing, like, coming to a group of people, like, we want to practice Zen, and kind of, well, how do you guys want to do it? But he would teach Zazen, yeah,
well, I mean,
as the core thing.
Yeah, because I felt like he was my Zazen teacher. And whenever we did Sesshin, you know, he would give a talk, but otherwise he was doing Zazen during the whole Sesshin. And his example of sitting there was, you know, the teaching.
People find their way from Zazen. And then we might say, but what if they're like, well, maybe if I sit once or twice a month, then that's okay, right? And maybe Koban would say, whatever you can.
Yeah. Depending on the circumstances. Because he would say sometimes you can't sit, you know, your family needs you, other things call, and you have to do those things.
Yeah.
He also said that the best thing is to sit all the your whole life. So.
Well, that's kind of like Rujing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can continue with this question forever. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.